It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. And in today's conversation, I'm going to be talking with Wayne Stratman about his work that has really encompassed more than 30 years of looking at lighted glass plasma technology. And so Wayne is an artist, a designer, a researcher, a teacher, advocate, author, all those great things. Wayne, welcome. And it's going to be exciting to have this conversation.
Oh, thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk with you.
So I'm really curious, and I'm sure listeners are curious about what is lighted glass plasma. We know about lighted glass, and we probably know about neon, which may be a form of that, but can you describe more what that is?
Well, that's right. Neon is exactly that, a plasma form of art form. It's bent tubing. Difference between plasma and neon, often people think plasma is a subset of neon. It's actually the reverse. Neon is a very specific form of plasma. We blow glass in a myriad of shapes, sizes, and in forms, and then fill it with not just uniformly glowing gas, but gases sometimes with mixed in materials that vaporize and at higher pressures so that we get movement. So if, when we blow a large volume, we may want a linear line to trace out the whole interior. By doing much higher pressures, say of krypton or xenon gas, we can get a linear line to move at virtually any speed we want.
Wow. So you use a wide variety of different gases. And when you talk about blowing, are you talking about mouth blowing these, or?
It can be either furnace blown glass, which is blown out of a furnace, like many people have seen either in person or on TV or something, or flamework glass. This is working like I do, primarily with torches, very, very large torches in some cases, and using equipment like a glass blower's lathe. It actually holds very large tubing and turns it, and we can make glass objects in the world.
Wow. So you've taken this, and then you use it not only to teach people about science, and you were telling me about one thing that you do, which is something with a tree. Can you describe how you might use it to teach science as a glass blower?
Well, sure. First of all, my business is probably 75% of the business is making things for science museums all over the world, from the plasma globes, which are ubiquitous in every large science museum, to many other things. But when I give demos at various places or master classes sometimes in glass around the world, one of the things I do is make live a glass tree and then fill it with a gas and make it light up. And while I do that, I take some time to talk to people about scientific principles. One thing we discussed earlier is how I try to teach people the basics of how a tree becomes a tree from a little seed. Where does the mass come from? And try to put together the concepts of the carbon dioxide in the air becomes essentially the mass of the tree. And that is the other half of the life equation, whereas us mammals and other moving organisms, we're producing the carbon dioxide. So it's what comes out of us goes into them and vice versa. Which is understanding that carbon cycle, which is you need to understand if you want to consider yourself an environmentalist. You've got to understand this is a cycle. And what's happening now is we're putting undue amounts of carbon that's normally buried in the ground into that ecology around us. And until we remove it, it's going to continue to raise the temperature of the earth and so on.
So really what you're talking about, and you know, these are ancient buried plant matter that, you know, captured the sun's energy. and then it got buried, and it was that energy was there, and now we release it all and rapidly, and the environment's not able to handle that CO2 release.
Right. That massive amounts of carbon. There, you know, the trees can only take up so much, and the oceans take up even more, but they're largely full.
Right. And then as we add to it, the complications with raising our temperatures, then there are places like the ocean are less able to hold on to it.
Exactly. Yeah. As well as the permafrost is right, thawing out, and gigatons are going to be released from that. And we're uncovering peat bogs, which also contain gigatons of stored carbon. So it's, and a lot of these are feedback mechanisms that they amplify the effect.
So this takes us full loop. Because what you do is you heat up a gas and it's expanding, which is what we're talking about when we talk about, you know, in permafrost or in the water, we're talking about as it gets warmer, the gas spreads out and it moves out of that storage. And you're using it actually to move glass to form other shapes.
Yes, in one sense, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I what I like about that is the whole idea that you can use heat and pressure to change what really is glass just really basically a set of minerals plus silica, or what is glass?
Yeah, it's very, very unique material, and most people don't know half of the known elements on the periodic table are used in making millions and millions of varieties of glass. Two general categories. We talk about hard glass, soft glass. Soft glass is all the cheap glass, you know, cheap drinking glasses and beer bottles and whatnot. Hard glass is the stuff you see in a laboratory work, where often called Pyrex in the U.S., but it's technically called borosilicate. I tend to use borosilicate, but there are other artists who use soft glass. That dictates what we can make with it. Depending on how it's worked and whatnot.
So is, I would assume that when you talk about hard glass, and we've all been in a lab, that glass can be more subjected to extremes of temperature, both cold and hot, right?
Exactly. And so we can actually rework it too.
You can rework it.
Yes. Wow. So if I blow a shape and then finish for the day, I can come back the next day and put a torch on it and start working. If it was soft glass, theoretically you can do it, but practically speaking, it becomes extremely difficult. You have to heat the entire piece up very, very slowly, or it'll just crack and break.
Wow. And then glass itself, right? Once it gets into that final form, I mean, you can rework it, but really it doesn't recycle itself very well, does it?
What do you mean by recycle?
Well, itself? Like if I have a glass jar and I smash it, it's not going back together.
No.
And so I can recycle it in some way, using it in some way as glass, you know, crumbles or whatever, but I'm not going to be able to make it back into what it was.
Well, you could remelt it indefinitely.
Good. Okay.
Yeah, sure. That's why they recycle glass.
Okay. So it gets remelted and then it goes back.
One thing you can't mix the type of glass. I work with the type of glass, of, you know, ordinary glass objects like bottles and whatnot, because the coefficients of expansion are drastically different, and they never want to mix the two together. You'd end up with essentially a third glass that's halfway in between, and it really will mess up any production techniques of making recycled items.
Wow. So how hot a working environment are you? I'm sure it depends on what you're working with, but basically what are the ranges of glass heat that you're using?
Well, first of all, glass is a unique material, and it has no specific melting point. Unlike, you know, take a metal, you heat it up to exactly a temperature, it melts. Glass just gets softer and softer and softer as you get higher in temperature. So we have a working range. So if you have a melt of soft glass, the cheap stuff, temperatures are usually around 2300 degrees Fahrenheit. Whereas borosilicate might be 400 to 500 degrees hotter than that. That's in the state. When we're working with torches, we're working at much, much higher temperatures.
And does that make it then flow more or more malleable for you to do that?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it makes it very, very liquid. And at some point, you can actually get the glass to boil, and you want to avoid that. That's techniques that sophisticated glass blowers do, so you never get essentially little bubbles of boiled glass inside your seals or whatever, because it aesthetically doesn't look very good.
Wow, that's really interesting. I never thought about glass reaching a boiling point, but that makes perfect sense.
Right? Yeah, every time you cut glass, for example, we like to cut it with a torch, heat it up and melt it apart. As you cut it by the typical methods of scoring and cracking it apart, those sharp edges, when it's reheated again, will tend to boil. And when you seal them back in, you'll carry that memory, essentially, of that boiling glass from that point on.
Wow. I had no idea. So what's the device look like to cut glass with heat?
Use a torch. Basically, torch. Heat is very, very soft, and then you blow into it, and you blow up a big bubble and pop it, and you've got essentially a cut end.
Oh, my goodness. That's really cool. So do you work both with a molten form and a liquid form, and do you all then tubes? Or how do you, when you're doing all the different things that you do, how are you working with the glass?
I've worked with almost every form in my history. I've worked out of a furnace. I've worked with even just using window glass and slumping and fusing that to some of my flat glass products. Many of your listeners have seen some of the Star Trek movies. Whenever they had a Borg character, had some of my flat plate lamps behind all the Borgs.
Oh, my goodness.
Most of the work I do over the last, say, 15 years, flame-worked borosilicate laboratory glass. And we use a variety of torches, from very, very tiny, we call a micro torch, to gigantic. Literally, I have to wear a full Kevlar suit and sometimes put an air line in the suit to keep myself from burning up, quite honestly.
Wow.
I'm working on a very large, long-term project right now, trying to learn to make full-size human body parts just by starting with glass tubing and blow them up. You can imagine a full-size human torso only made using torches. It's quite complicated, quite challenging.
Yeah, this is not 3D printing, so you have to think from the inside out, correct?
Right. You have to think thicknesses and volumes, and everything I do eventually is getting put under vacuum so I can fill it full of gases. So I have to worry about stresses that would cause the piece to implode as well.
Oh, my goodness.
The world of science in what I'm doing. It's hand in glove. The science and the art part go together.
So that's why I wanted to talk to you, was that you really are working. And as we know, there is no two sides of the brain. We've kind of debunked that myth, but you're really working with your full brain, which is all the parts, thinking with the creative part and the artistic part and the aesthetic part. But you also have to know some really basic, even more than basic science, to keep yourself safe and to be able to do the things you want to do.
Also a key, I particularly think it keeps you humble in a way. And I see constantly people who know just enough of a particular science to be dangerous in a way. And that oftentimes I see the exceptions to the rules all the time, established dogma about how something works. Well, in making an art piece, I come up constantly with these anomalies, often that end up being art pieces. Because I can see things immediately and visually, which, by the way, when we talk about the history of science, I just completed writing a book with a lot of history of our field, and the opening up of lighted sculpture in the late 19th century allowed scientists to see a lot of phenomena that led to the understanding of the electron and cathode rays and x-rays, all sorts of things that the ability to actually see what's going on really added to their understanding.
Wow. Is your book out yet, published yet?
It's about to be printed.
But yeah, awesome. Printed. So what's the title?
The Art of Plasma.
The Art of Plasma. How cool. Yeah, we'll make sure that listeners can always get on our website and look at a link to things, and we'll make sure we link you out to that.
Okay.
That's really exciting. So the history of all this, and you're right, glass blowing is really old. It's a really kind of an ancient idea, but it has evolved with all kinds of new kinds of ways that we can do it. But it's still basically using some of the same techniques, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah. And particularly in flame working, a lot of the techniques go back 100 years. Actually, the torches used in most neon shops were patented in the 1890s by a legendary inventor that most modern Americans have never heard of. It may be the subject of my next book, Daniel McFarlane Moore. He was a contemporary of Tesla and Edison and actually worked with both of them. And he developed all the tubular lighting and as well as all the glass blowing torches to make it. A fascinating history. And poor guy, his name's been lost because Edison bought him and all his stuff up and actively apparently tried to make him disappear from history because he didn't like the rivalry of this other inventor.
Yeah, I've heard that about Edison before. That's really interesting. That that in specific to Moore, but to other. Yeah, he did have really strong rivalries, as did a lot of the early scientists that were around.
Speaking of rivalries,
his
life being shot to death in his front lawn by a rival inventor back in the 1930s and made worldwide front page news at the time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
And what was the rivalry over?
Oh, it was... The guy may have been a little bit deranged, something that Moore already had patented and whatnot. I mean, it's a complicated, interesting story. We've looked into it deeply, even talked to some of Moore's ancestors. And apparently they demonized the guy who shot Moore, but only a few weeks earlier, he may have actually saved a child from drowning. So quite a complicated and interesting story. We haven't confirmed that yet, but...
Yeah, but that is like most stories, you know, when we interview somebody that did a mass killing and they go, their neighbors go, oh, it was just such a wonderful person.
Right.
And that's true. I mean, you don't necessarily have any early warning signs of somebody that might, you know, go and get angry and change who they are.
Let me tell you just one anecdote about Daniel McFarlane Moore. He created a whole field called glass plumbers back around the 1900s. And what they did is they would go into buildings, renowned buildings, including the New York Post Office or the London Underground, and take glass tubing on site and seal length after length after length up to 275 feet long and make one long tubular light that would light the entire structure. And to date, I don't know anybody in our modern times know how he was able to do that.
That's just phenomenal that he could have even envisioned that. And we still don't know exactly how.
Right. And the tubes were filled with either carbon dioxide or nitrogen gas, which doesn't last long, unfortunately, because it's so chemically active. So he had to actually make his own breather valves, as he called it. So he created this little container where he actually made his own CO2 or nitrogen, and it fed into the tube about once every minute, making up the lost gas. It's an absolute marvel of engineering. And like I said, they existed up through early, I think, the World War II era in the London Underground.
Did he do that, do you think? Was he working on a problem that he wanted to solve, like creating something? And then he had to evolve the engineering to help?
He worked in Edison's lab and then left Edison's lab because he thought he could make a better form of light. And he did. And he made a light much closer to daylight. And that's why Edison wanted to make him disappear. His lights were linear, beautiful white, and could be tailored to the environment as opposed to the rapidly burning out incandescence of the Edison bulb. So
he was using more of the gas and the plasma, right, to create the light?
Absolutely, yes.
Instead of using a filament, which we all know in the vacuum, eventually that heat and cooling burns it out.
That's right, yeah.
Oh my goodness. I can see why Edison, you know, that would have revolutionized, we would have had plasma-like fluorescence, but way before we did.
Yeah, fluorescence didn't really come about until about the 1930s. So there was about a 30-year gap before they came up with some other technical advances. And actually, poor Mr. Moore, he didn't have the access to inert gases because they hadn't been discovered. As a matter of fact, one of the discoverers of the inert gases in our atmosphere, one of the guys, the English inventors, actually gave Moore a champagne bottle with some of the first neon in it back early 1900s.
So when we think about using a gas and we think about color, right, we can color with different minerals, a glass tube, that's one thing. But when we think about that glowing, do we use different gases? Do we excite it at different levels? How do you get different coloration in the gas within a tube?
Well, there's three ways of getting color in my type of work. As you mentioned, gas colors, everybody's familiar with that bright orange, red, neon gas. And sometimes in other types of neon signs, you see that light blue, which is an argon gas with a little bit of mercury. You're actually seeing mercury vapor. But there are just a handful of inert gases you can use. But you can change their look by their pressure. For example, xenon can be a nice, rich blue at low pressure, but it can be a brilliant white lime at higher pressure. And you can have mixtures of gases as well. So you can get an arc that starts out red and finishes blue or vice versa. And then second way you mentioned is colored glasses. You can actually filter the color. And the third way, something I do a lot of, is use chemical phosphors. Phosphors are essentially ceramic materials that have been ground up. And they, when excited by UV light, they re-emit in the visible portion. Again, it was found in the 19th century when they had made their early lamps that produce some UV, that various rocks would fluoresce. Now, you see them if you go in a mineral museum. They often have rocks under UV lights. Well, if you crush those rocks up, you have a phosphor.
It's and then you can use that to excite it, right?
You excite it and you get a lot of light up. It's an exceptional amount of light that comes out of a phosphor.
So when we talk about, some of our listeners may not know, but what do we mean by when we talk about exciting something?
Oh, right. So you're basically taking a very energetic, exciting wavelength, which is towards ultraviolet. You know, that's why the ultraviolet will tan your skin or burn you. It's got a lot of energy there. And by putting into certain minerals, they absorb that and re-emit it, but always at a lower frequency, which happens to be in the visible light that we see. So you start with frequencies from the blue into the ultraviolet to produce the warmer colors, the greens, whites, reds, that type of color.
So when we're talking about it, like, you know, like a neon sign, which is not only neon, but other gases, as you said, argon, others, to get colors. But when we're talking about those, then we're talking about needing a source of electricity, right? To create that excitement within them.
Right. So we're dealing with plasma. There's two basic types of plasma in the universe. The thermal plasmas that, as I say in my book, if you go out at night, look up the night sky, everything you see is a result of plasma. Those are thermal plasmas that happen in the core of stars and whatnot. In a neon tube, we're using electrically excited plasmas. The gases are very, very low pressure. The atoms are, relatively speaking, widely spaced. So you can essentially, if you put a positive charge at one end of the tube and a negative the other, you get the positive ions moving one way, negative ions going the other. It forms a cascade effect, knocking electrons off. And when they come back together, they emit light. And it's usually of a very characteristic frequency, depending on the gas.
Wow. So you're imparting, through the electricity, you're imparting an energy to it that gets them moving.
Right.
And then when they come and they merge together, there's excess energy. They give that off, but they happen to give that off in the form of light energy.
Yeah. Another little factoid for your audience is it's very hard to start some tubes. In other words, if you take a neon tube, a fluorescent lamp deep under the earth, you'd have a hard time starting it because the actual first ionizations or the breaking apart of the atom are caused by random cosmic rays that happen to hit them. So our fluorescent lamps worldwide start easier during peaks of the 11-year peak of solar activity. It's producing cosmic rays that hit the earth and are starting a lot of our fluorescent lamps all over the planet.
Oh, that's amazing. I bet, again, I don't think people are aware of that phenomenon either.
Sometimes they have to actually put tiny traces of radioactive gases in some lamps to get that random starting effect, because without it, it takes a lot of voltage to get these lamps to get started.
Yeah, and I think about lightning, which is a lot of voltage coming at one time, and it almost excites the air as a plasma sometimes.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That's really great. Well, exactly. I've been talking about
The mechanism of lightning is actually still not understood.
Completely, right. I've been talking with Wayne Stratman about his work on lighted glass plasma technology, both as an artist, a designer, and a scientist too, because you're exploring that world as well. Please join us for more conversation after a short break.
This is Dave Baghdad, host of The Kitchen Party Kaylee. I hope you'll join me every Sunday at 10 p.m. for the best music from Ireland, Scotland, Canada, and the U.S. The Kitchen Party Kaylee, Celtic music from across the globe and across town.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and today we're having a conversation with Wayne Stratman. Wayne describes what he does through a statement that he's put out there on his website, which is essentially, what I do is take electricity and turn it into light using glass as the medium. And that's what we've been talking about. And you boil down what is really, really complicated into, I think, a very simple sentence for us that kind of in essence has it. What I'm amazed with is that you keep using the word plasma, and I know that people think of states of matter, and they probably learned in school three of them. And so they learned about a solid, and then a liquid, and a gas. And it's amazing to me, there is another one, and that's the word you're talking about. Can you describe, what is a plasma anyway?
Well, as you take a material and you keep adding energy to it, heat a solid and becomes a liquid, and more energy, it becomes a gas. More energy even yet, thermally or electrically, you actually get the atom, the outer electrons, to leave the atom. And when they ultimately come back and rejoin the atom, they release energy of a specific frequency. That's why neon gas will always be that orange red that we're familiar with. But yes, plasma, well, it used to be the most dominant form of matter, recently dethroned by dark matter, which nobody described yet, but it still makes up of all the forms of matter that we're familiar with, the dominant one in the universe.
So our sun basically is just big plasma ball. I mean, there's more to it, but that's basically what it's doing.
A big thermal plasma, right.
And it's giving off both, it gives off heat, but it gives off light. There's just a lot of things happening in that one.
Well, it's all electromagnetic spectrum. The lower energy stuff is the heat, infrared. The higher energy goes through light, up through, the higher frequencies, all the way up through X-rays and whatnot. Very, very energetic stuff.
Wow. And so when we look up, as you said, we look up at the night sky, most of the visible things we're seeing are definitely plasmas that are out there. And that's why it's so ubiquitous everywhere.
Right.
That's just really quite amazing. And then, of course, that plasma has made it possible for life on Earth. And so, it imparts part of the spectrum that we need for plants to carry on their photosynthesis as well.
That's right. Yeah.
Really, really amazing cycle. Where would we be without our plasmas? And I like the idea that, you know, that it's a basic thing that really nature's been doing since the beginning of at least our known universe, is igniting these kind of plasmas around the thing. But now you can turn those in and use them in an artistic form. So back to your art, I'm really intrigued about how you come up with a particular design. I know sometimes it's probably prescribed by a museum that wants something, but on your artistic side, when you're just being creative, what drives you?
As many things as I'm interested in, which is a lot. I'm an avid reader. I've got multiple degrees and particularly interested. My first degree was in psychology before engineering. So the last solo show I had, I did a lot of using psychological principles to essentially give me ideas for a sculpture. For example, I made one piece that's currently on show at the Sandwich Glass Museum from that earlier show, The Landscape of the Mind. It's an antique console with 18 antique looking dials, gauges. And each one is labeled as human emotion. And they're all connected to 18 what are called Jacob's ladders. You've seen these if you've seen a Frankenstein film. It's a climbing arc. And depending on how you tune up the various emotional states that are on each gauge, shows a different landscape in terms of how tall an arc is created in one of those Jacob's ladders. The whole idea being looking at this conceptual landscape of all the emotions that constantly compete and, you know, flow together in human mind. And I just wanted to essentially make that visible. And so that whole show, I had made objects around ideas around psychology.
That's fascinating. So you modeled out a way of us visualizing what emotions do, and do they have collisions at all, or do they interact with one another?
And it's just my vision of how
correct
I'd like to think about things. Like oftentimes people think about their friendships and why certain friends are closer and it's different levels than others. And well, that's the beginning of a sculpture for me right there. I've made two giant bell jars full of lightning in another exhibit. And I had two blown glass brains. And the piece was about communication. The lightning symbolized all the preconceived background stuff, our prejudices and whatnot, that we have to somehow communicate from one brain to another through all this stuff. And again, I'm just using this as core material to create.
One of the things I do a lot of times when I talk to different artists and scientists is, you know, that collaboration between the artist and scientist. In your case, you are collaborating with yourself. And I love this idea, because what you're doing is there are times that you work for somebody who wants a specific thing, and then you're sort of working as an artist, but more as a technician for something. But what you're talking about is taking a concept that you have in your head, like a visual artist would, or a musician, and realizing that in the medium that you use of glass and plasma. And that is really your own collaboration in there.
Right. It's true. For example, during the pandemic, I was moved to make a piece sort of my comment, what was going on. I made a coat rack, which had six of those climbing arc Jacob's ladders hanging from each coat rack point. And five out of six of them were lit, and five out of six had either a scarf or a hat, and one of them was dead. One of them was gone. No longer there was a light there. So light, using light as a metaphor, has so many connotations and connections. And it can be inspiration, it can be life itself. I guess if I had to simplify my title more, I would say I'm basically a light artist, because that's where I started years and years ago.
Yeah, and I do like that concept. You know, through mythology and through religions and writings and that, people talk and describe things in terms of light and, you know, and where there's a light or absence of light. And you're absolutely correct. It's something that we use metaphorically all the time. I'm curious too about, so you talked about having that interest in psychology and doing that in the brain and all that. What are some of the other things that have made their way into modeling in glass and plasma?
I have to think about my home and my own personal collection. I have one piece from a mathematics series I did years ago when essentially took abstract mathematical concepts and turned them into light sculptures. Like I made some sculptures that modeled two different mathematical ways to look at like a waveform, the classical versus the new chaotic system of mathematics. Or I made some pieces that I've enjoyed other artists' work. For example, Picasso's line drawings. So for a period of time, I made a number of his line drawings in a very subtle argon-filled neon. I've done an awful lot lately with human brain and actual neurons and connections, because I find a lot meaningful there. And I'd like to actually continue to do that. And there's a lot of connection between the way neurons grow and where other fractal geometry exists in living things and coastlines and many other things. A lot of abstract concepts I try to bring down to something concrete that I can build as a sculpture.
Yeah, and I can see the actual connection there pretty easily. People are used to when we try to represent neurons firing as a video or as an animation, it does look somewhat like the lines that we see in a plasma or an excitement in lightning, which I think is really fascinating. But you're in that medium, so you're able to even represent it closer to what we might imagine it being.
By the way, the word plasma came from the great American physicist Langmuir back in the 1920s. When he said gas plasmas reminded him of biological systems. And so that's where that word came from. It's about 100 years old this decade.
That's really amazing. Imagining the how they do remind us of systems that are operating. When you're working, do you get this kind of, sometimes it just takes you somewhere that you didn't think that you were going to go right away? Like you're working on something and then all of a sudden in the glass, there's something that's happening.
Yeah. Many times I just sit and play with techniques and they suggest something to me, honestly. Particularly visual effects. Lots of times we put gas into some volume and try different power supplies, different types of electronics, and all of a sudden something emerges I wasn't looking for. That serendipity is a big part of what people think is some sort of genius on my part. It's basically, like a lot of researchers in history, I stumbled across something and I'll take credit for it, but really wasn't a plan. That's why I like studying. And part of my book is the history of electricity, vacuum science, and glass, because a lot of this people just having a fascination for the world and a curiosity, the old natural philosophy of studying the world and coming across things, because you just are interested in everything.
Wow. I think you have summarized what I try to get across a lot with doing this art science kind of connection. And that is that really science is not about this scientific method, this process that is about there, but it is really about playing around and random discovery and seeing what others don't see in it. And I think that is really important that people get that idea that what a scientist is somebody who is exploring the edges of something without knowing exactly a plan of how they're going to get to where they were going.
right, but the scientific method is important because depends what you do with it. You know, most of this scientific method started around 1600 with a few noted people who stopped taking the dogma largely backed by the church and say, well, let's do some experiments and actually find out what happens here.
Yeah, so that part of it, and then I always talk about different science methods. They're different in every field. But it, that becomes, you're right, the way of separating out our own bias or our own confirmation bias from something. And so we do go on that process. But I think my reaction was more to, it's a lot of times it's something that we can teach kids and that becomes the whole of science and they lose the excitement of that actual discovery, which is essential. I mean, you're uncovering things as you mess about with things.
Right. You speak about education. That's, as you know, a strong interest of mine because I don't think kids get a chance to really do much playing about as they used to. At least when I was growing up, we were making all sorts of dangerous things regularly. I guess those of us that survived a love for, you know, physical sciences, chemistry, whatnot. And, it's too much computerized stuff nowadays and very little actual playing around with stuff.
Yeah. And what I do like about your work is you're still very much in the actual physical world with that. And even though you're using some of the things that are like what we might use in the digital world, you're still in the physical world. So you're still touching, bending, you know, putting pressures on things using electricity.
Yeah. I always say I'm a master of 19th century techniques, quite honestly. Yeah. I've actually extended the work of Geissler, who is the grandfather of our field, who did a lot of this work back in the 1850s and on. He created the first gas discharge tubes and played around with phosphors and he invented a vacuum pump. And, it was all coming together right about then.
Huh. So what the quest was has always been to light up our darkness in some way. So, you know, we did it by burning fuels inside of a lantern or something, you know, that's where that whole problem with killing too many whales, that industry was for oil that we used for whale oil lamps and other things. But I think it's interesting how that has evolved. And so part of your uncovering history, can you describe a little bit of the evolution of that?
This is big topic.
Big topic, I know.
Yeah, but you know, there's always been an interest in what they call cold light, light that comes from things that are not burning. And there are many things from the aurora borealis to, you know, lightning bugs and many other things, rotting fish. And matter of fact, if you really want to look into it, how they lit coal mines is a fascinating topic. Some of the things, they literally at one point used rotting fish to give a slight glow in coal mines.
Really?
Yeah, or have a child sit by you and make sparks all day long by rubbing a piece of metal on a stone. And I mean, the search for cold light was a long and dangerous one. There's some fascinating stories. In coal mines, for example, they had to get a cold light because they would regularly get blown out of the mines due to exploding coal gases.
So you're not going to take a lighted something down there. You know, your torch is going to be a real problem for you.
Well, I'll tell you a little story that I read about a short-lived profession called the penitent. It was one person, I guess, would get promoted to this field where they'd wrap him in some sort of cloth, soak him with water, and give him a long stick with a candle at the end. And his job was to find the exploding gases. And if you can imagine that job, I don't imagine they paid a lot of pensions.
No, and that's, you know, we tell you here about the canary in the coal mine. This is the human in the coal mine.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine the thought process behind that would be okay. But I guess, you know, it's better than blowing up everybody. So you sense the one person is the volunteer or was volunteered and that their job was go. Oh my goodness. That's just an incredible story. So I'm curious, how in the world did rotting fish give off light?
It's basically, I guess it would be a chemiluminescence. I stumbled on a book from, I believe, a researcher from Princeton. He wrote about a 3-inch thick book of just basically cold light sources before 1900. And it's one of many, many. There were many, many more, quite honestly. People have been fascinated because they assumed all light had to come from heat, and there was no heat.
And I'm assuming maybe in the rotting fish, it's the bacteria that's chemiluminescing.
Right, exactly.
And so it's not actually the fish, but the fish is going through its decomposition. It's being consumed by bacteria that chemiluminesce.
Yeah, that's outside my field.
Yeah, I'm just guessing. There's probably somebody out there listening who knows better than what we know about this. But I'm fascinated that that whole idea that somebody would take rotting fish into a mine to be able to illuminate it. Because, again, what you said, it's better than the guy with the candle going down through that thing.
They did find, starting roughly in 1600 and forward, that electricity and light were somehow connected. First of all, they had a hollow ball that they could rotate, and then one under a vacuum, maybe a little mercury inside, you could start to see glow, and that slowly grew and grew and grew until you started to see some combination of vacuum, glass, and electricity was starting to result in light. And there were some big jumps, big understandings that caused the field to accelerate. Along that history. That's what I wrote about in the book.
That's great. Well, just a reminder that the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations that explore the intersections between arts and science. We encourage you at home to do the same explorations that we're doing here. Have conversations with others, explore ideas, and even ideas that we've talked about on today's show. In a few minutes, we'll be right back.
No alarm clock. No traffic to negotiate. No staff meetings to attend. Sunday is your day, so do yourself a favor. Tune out all that noise and tune in for Sunday Baroque.
Sunday morning from 5 to 9 here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and in this segment, we're talking with Wayne Stratman about his newest exhibit, which is Pure Effects at the Sandwich Glass Museum, which is in Sandwich, Massachusetts. And Wayne, in that, you're really combining together a lot of the elements that you do both as an artist and what you're researching and exploring. But I also am really interested, and you said this early on a couple of times when we've been talking, about the role of education and the importance of that. And I got a feeling that why you have an exhibition in a museum is partly education as well as just showing the work.
Exactly. That's why the name Pure Effects. I asked the museum if they'd like me to create a number of pieces that were expressly there for people to go and interact with them. So there's three big pieces where people can actually go over and rub their hands over. They can direct the light in different ways. They can see the difference between different gases and the way things are lit up, and really interact with plasma one-on-one. Whereas most of the rest of the exhibit is behind, you know, barriers, because we don't want people going messing with high voltage and a lot of the delicate parts of the sculptures. But those pieces are expressly there, especially for kids to come in and get maybe psyched on seeing something new and different.
Yeah, I think that sometimes we do things, which is just fine for the pure aesthetics of it to have it. But I think it's really a meaningful that part of your own mission is really to help inspire us to think about things and to wonder and have a lot of curiosity even about how did he do that?
Right. Actually, you bring up something I should mention, that when looking at the works in that museum show, there are two directions of meaningfulness you can go in. And this is characteristic of all my work. You can go down the road of the scientific. How does it work? And a lot of people are fascinated and have great questions, which I love to answer. But then there's also the meaningfulness. I described a piece earlier on the show, The Landscape of the Mind. Oftentimes people miss some of the meaningfulness because they're moving so fast through the museum, or there's no docent there, or no written explanation. So there's levels of meaningfulness that are there for those who are interested. And I hope people take the time, ask the questions, contact me if they'd like. I'd be happy to guide them. That's what this is all about. It's a communication industry.
For this I think you summarized those two sides of how we might explore that. And we're probably going back and forth between them. And it's really amazing to me when you watch people, well, my background was in museum work, and you watch people navigate an exhibit. And they really are all over the place at different moments in terms of where they are psychological. Sometimes it's the wow effect, I'm wondering how, but other times I'm just moved by it. Or it starts other thoughts. Where have I seen this, or what is it like? I want to do something like this. So you're right. It is for the visitor coming in. It's a really, you're trying to hit as many of those triggers as you possibly can.
Yeah, all I can do is offer them up, and hopefully they will take the time to, you know, lots of times museums are information overload.
Yeah, absolutely.
More science themed amusement parks. There's too much thrown at you, and a lot of the stuff that people don't take the time to understand it, unfortunately, there's so much there.
Yeah, I think back to the early days of exhibits like Frank Oppenheimer used to do out in the Exploratorium in California, where he would just have an artist and scientist kind of working around, and they'd try something and they'd stick it out there and see how visitors interacted with it. To the days that we, in some of our science museums, where we have to didactically teach about a particular concept. And I think there is a big difference between walking up to one of your exhibits, understanding a little bit about maybe what the artist was doing, but it's less about the labels and the information that you're providing. It's more about what is it doing in terms of what it's helping to stimulate within the learner.
Yes, I wish there was more of those ideas, honestly, behind the science museums that we work with. Lots of times it's trade show builders who really, very nice people, don't understand the science and not particularly interested. But I try to guide them to more interesting things, but you know, there's basically, well, we just want this, and it stops there.
It does. It's a really, we could spend a long time on this particular topic, because I do think it's a real concern to have moved. Almost we get too slick with what we're doing.
Exactly, right.
And we moved away from really, there's some simple phenomenon there. And that's what I love about your work, Wayne, is this idea that you're using an age-old, simple thing, right? Like you said, you're a 19th century artist. This is not new stuff, although there's new stuff in it. But what I mean is that you're using that very simple kind of thing to further deeper understanding. That's pretty amazing.
I'll say one piece. It's a fairly new piece that I made in the last year and a half or so. It came directly from my researches from early electrical science. And it's a spiraling tube. It's a tube that makes a linear discharge between one end to the other, but immediately it starts spiraling. And over a number of minutes, it makes an absolutely perfect spiral. And this comes from very simple principles that Michael Faraday worked with back in the 1820s onward. And I've had PhDs from MIT and Harvard here who spend an evening and scratching their heads at how I did this. And I tell them there's nothing moving in it. It's based on almost a first year physics principle, but it's a learning experience for even people at that level. And I love playing with that. And there are a number of pieces I can't explain. I regularly get my science friends in here and we sit down and think about what is going on in there?
So that's the key to education. You just summarized it. It's the quest.
Curiosity.
It's the curiosity. Quest of that. Yeah, finding things that, you know, if we just keep going and doing a lab of something we already have know about, maybe right. It's new to the person doing the lab, and I'm not dinging that we need labs. I'm just saying it's interesting, but how often do we give high schoolers or do we give elementary children the chance to actually not have an answer from the teacher because they don't know either?
Right. Yeah.
And that's the quest. And that's really science and art together combined in the right way. So,
yeah.
I'm very excited. This was a great conversation. I want to thank you, Wayne, from Wayne Stratman Design in Boston. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.